the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program, broadcasting to you live today from Sandestin, Florida. Here we are at the end of the week, and it's time to have a discussion about one of those things that causes parents sometimes to scratch the head. And it'll be a whole lot more concerning if parents look deeper at the issue and find out what's really going on with their teenagers, children, and the Internet. We come back to this issue time and time again because the Internet has opened all new kinds of opportunities for communication, for the transmission of information. It is literally an entry point into an ocean of information, some of it very positive, some of it very healthy, some of it very educational, some of it very poisonous, some of it very pornographic, some of it very violent and very dangerous. It's really one of those things that makes a parent understand that you're never talking about mere technology. You're talking about technology that comes with a huge set of moral questions. Harlan Coben is a novelist well-known in American literature. He wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times published just a few days ago entitled The Undercover Parent. He begins the article this way. Not long ago, friends of mine confessed over dinner that they had put spyware on their 15-year-old son's computer so they could monitor all he did online. At first, I was repelled at this invasion of privacy. Now, after doing a fair amount of research, I get it. So here you have one man saying, I get it. I understand why it would be advisable for parents to monitor and to regulate exactly what kind of computer access goes on. And especially with the Internet, what kind of activities going on with their children, especially older and teenage children, with many of them having unrestricted access right now to the Internet. Now, this is a secular author writing in a secular newspaper, the New York Times, after all, and the backlash on this has been fascinating. A whole series of letters in which people are writing back to Harlan Coben saying, look, this is like the Nazis. This is like a communist government. This is like parents as dictators. The most interesting aspect of this entire controversy really isn't about the Internet. It's about changing concepts of parenthood, and it's about changing concepts of children, where obviously a good number of people in the United States think of children as autonomous individuals, and parents as, I guess the best way to put it would be, they're facilitators for self-actualization. I think most parents instinctively have a very different understanding. We're going to have a conversation about this. It's going to be about parenthood and the Internet. Let's put those two issues together and make sure we understand they belong together for this conversation, parenthood and the Internet. We'll look forward to your calls as you have an opportunity to call us. We'll be to that in just a moment. First, to review some issues in the news. Former Vice President Al Gore, having won the Nobel Prize, is now back to say that those who doubt that global warming is caused by humanity are acting like fringe lunatics who think the 1969 moon landing never really happened. Now, that's an interesting way to put it. What you have here is a reminder of the fact that there are extremists all over the place on this issue. And when you find this kind of language, you know you've hit a nerve. And when you have a former vice president of the United States who now considers himself, and these are his own words, the PR agent for the planet, you have a man who has a rather firm understanding of at least what he thinks should be obvious to everyone. And then when you have someone like that, it becomes a real topic of frustration when they find that not everyone sees it as so obvious as they do. Confronted by Leslie Stahl with the fact that some prominent people, including the nation's vice president, are not convinced that global warming is man-made, Vice President Gore responded, "You're talking about Dick Cheney. I think that those people are such a tiny, tiny minority now with their point of view. They're almost like the ones who still believe that the moon landing was staged in a movie lot in Arizona and those who believe the world is flat. That demeans them a little bit, but it's not that far off," end quote. Well, you can decide what you want to do with that, but my response to this is that that kind of extremist language really indicates more about the speaker than about those about whom he would seek to speak. When you're looking at climate change, let's be honest. My main concern is we don't have sufficient data to draw any absolutely dogmatic conclusions. And that means that calling someone on the other side a fringe simply because they hold to a different position, and especially comparing them with people who don't think the moon landings took place, well, we'll just let that speak for itself. Speaking for some data that will surprise a lot of Americans, Arthur C. Brooks is back with some fascinating data, writing in The American and also in The Economist of London and in The Wall Street Journal. Arthur Brooks is coming back to suggest that once again the data on charitable giving in the United States is stunning, and actually quite surprising. In 2006, Americans gave $295 billion to charity. That was up 4.2% over 2005 levels, and charitable giving has been generally rising faster than the growth of the American economy for more than half the century. Now, what is fascinating about this and counterintuitive is that the people who are most likely to give are people who are actually themselves possessed of less money. In other words, the rich do not give that much. It is persons who are middle and lower income who actually give not only a far larger percentage of their income, but at least to many charitable causes, give the vast majority of the dollars as well. Also, it turns out that those who identify as conservatives give a good deal more than those who identify as liberals. Now, what's fascinating about this whole conversation is some of the liberals say we don't give because we believe it should be confiscated through taxes and distributed by the government. Well, that really does show a worldview clash here. If you believe, like most conservatives believe, that there is a responsibility generously to support worthy causes, then you have private individuals giving to private causes. If you believe that the money should be instead confiscated and wealth should be redistributed, and that this should happen by government confiscation through the tax system, then that pretty much does define you as a liberal. The Internal Revenue Service records show that only about a third of people who file tax returns itemize their deductions, which mean that most Americans, particularly middle and lower income citizens, don't even claim the deductions to which they are entitled. Where does the money go? Another interesting question. Most estimates place the percentage of American households that make monetary contributions each year at 70 to 80%. That's encouraging. And the average American household contributes more than $1,000 annually. Now, a lot of people would say most of that must be going to churches. That's not true. Although churches are the largest single recipient, about a third of individual gifts go to activities such as education and health and social welfare. And, in fact, some studies indicate that only a third of individual gifts go to churches directly in terms of church activities. Arthur Brooks is also cited in The Economist, and you're going to find this very interesting because one of the most interesting aspects of his research is how it continually piles up irrefutable evidence about that which is counterintuitive. People in the media generally talk as if the statistics would indicate that, for instance, liberals give more than conservatives. Turns out that all the documentation shows that conservatives give more than liberals. You would think that wealthy people would give more than middle and lower income people. Turns out that the opposite is true. It turns out also, as The Economist is reporting, and again, this is not a conservative publication, certainly not a Christian publication. The Economist is you could say it's the combination of Time Magazine and the Wall Street Journal of Great Britain. It has a lead article entitled, Why Conservatives Are Happier Than Liberals. You want to know why? It's because conservatives are more likely to have children, and it turns out that gross national happiness is tied to the number of children. Listen to this. American parents are much more likely to be happy than non-parents. Now, that is by their own self-reporting. Mr. Brooks, an economist at Syracuse University, suggests that this is for two reasons. Number one, even if children are irksome now, they lend meaning to life in the long term. So, in other words, parenting, honestly, can be frustrating at any general moment, but it's incredibly fulfilling in the long term, in the big picture. And the kind of people who are happy are also likely to have more children. So it works both ways. It turns out the happy people decide to have children. Unhappy people decide not to have children. And then it goes on, Mr. Brooks' research indicates that those who identify as themselves as conservatives actually report themselves to be happier than liberals as well. From Canada also comes a report that there is a division coming in the Anglican Church of Canada. This has been seen for some time. Canada is a left-leaning place politically, and certainly when it comes to the Anglican Church in Canada, it's been leaning left for a long time. The Diocese of New Westminster, which includes Vancouver in 2002, became the first diocese in the entire Anglican Communion to devise and to authorize the blessing of same-sex partnerships. Conservatives have objected to this quite loudly with a great deal of articulate concern, and now they were beginning to leave the Anglican Church of Canada. Now, the reason for that is that last year, Canada's General Synod resolved that same-sex marriages, or blessings as they're known in Canada, are not in conflict with core doctrine. They rejected a moratorium. Now, let's just consider what was necessary for the General Synod of this church to come to that conclusion. They had to deny the clear teachings of Scripture. What you have a situation here is real clear. This situation is one in which you had a church, or that which is posing as a church, to directly confront and to contradict the teachings of Scripture and to do so in such a way that it is now causing the traditional conservative believing evangelical wing of the Anglican Church in Canada to leave. Perhaps the most famous of these who have since withdrawn is the Anglican theologian J.I. Packer. And earlier this week, we indicated that Dr. Packer is now the subject of disciplinary action from the Anglican Church in Canada, from the Diocese of New Westminster, to strip him of his ministerial credentials. So this is indeed a picture right out of the book of Revelation, in which you have a church. It's known as a church, but it turns its back on Scripture. And instead of disciplining those who stand against the authority of Scripture, they seek to strip the ministerial credentials of one who had to withdraw simply because of the heretical teachings of the church. That tells you a great deal about where we are in postmodern America and where the Canadians are in their own postmodern culture. Back to talk about parents and the internet. You're listening coast to coast to the Albert Miller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Moeller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Moeller Program. The call line is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We're talking about the question, should parents use spyware? And in particular, the kind of spyware that would track and restrict the movements of their children and teenagers on the internet. Harlan Coben wrote the article, an op-ed piece in the New York Times. It's very, very interesting because what he writes about is the kind of stuff that a lot of conservative parents have been talking about for a very long time. This is not news. This would not make the newspaper in most conservative circles. Nonetheless, it is newsworthy when you start looking at this whole question of how the secular world looks at parenthood and children, at adolescence and at the internet. Let me just read to you a little bit again from Harlan Coben's article. He says, not long ago, friends of mine confessed over dinner that they had put spyware on their 15-year-old son's computer so they could monitor all he did online. At first, I was repelled at this invasion of privacy. Now, after doing a fair amount of research, I get it. It's an interesting confession, little admission. I get it. Those three words, pretty significant there. He goes on and says, make no mistake, if you put spyware on your computer, you will have the ability to log every keystroke your child makes and thus a good portion of his or her private world. That's what spyware is, at least the parental monitoring kind. You don't have to be an expert to put it on your computer. You just download the software from a vendor and you'll receive reports weekly, daily, whatever, showing you everything your child is doing on the machine. Scary, but a good idea. Most parents won't even consider it. Maybe it's the word, spyware. Says it leads to associations of someone sitting in a dark room, rubbing his hands together and reading your most private thoughts. But this isn't the government we're talking about. This is your family. It's a mistake to confuse the two. Loving parents are doing the surveillance here, not faceless bureaucrats. And most parents already monitor their children, watching over their home environment, their school. Today's overprotective parents fight their kids' battles on the playground, berate coaches about playing time, and fill out college applications. Yet when it comes to chatting with pedophiles or watching beheadings or gambling away their entire life savings, well, then their children deserve independence. Some will say you should simply trust your child, that if he is old enough to go on the internet, he's old enough to know the dangers. Trust is one thing, but surrendering parental responsibility to a machine that allows the entire world access to your home borders on negligence. Some will say that it's better just to use parental blocks that deny access to risky sites. I have found that they don't work. Children know how to get around them. But more than that, and this is where it gets tough, I want to know what's being said in email and instant messages and in chat rooms. Now, he goes on and on and on and on and on. Now, this is really, really interesting. Because I think most of us look at this and say, it sounds to me pretty obvious. I think most parents will look at this and say, yes, that makes perfect sense. I reject the notion that children are autonomous individuals who deserve the kind of privacy. They can talk with anyone, anywhere, go to any site for any reason without parental involvement, restriction, or tracking. And yet, I wonder how many Christian parents right now saying, I agree with this guy, actually do it. Because I think there are an awful lot of hypothetical parents doing hypothetical parenting out here who look at this and say, yeah, that makes a whole lot of sense. Well, let me just illuminate the situation by looking not just at Harlan Coben's op-ed piece, which is a lot longer than the section I just read with you there, but some letters to the editor that came in the following week. Listen to this. Carol Weston, who is an advice columnist for Girls Life magazine, writes to say, as a mother and advice columnist for girls, I disagree. For most parents, spyware is not only unnecessary, it also sends the unfortunate message, I don't trust you. Mr. Coben said a friend of his using spyware to monitor his college-bound straight-A daughter found that she was not only using drugs, but she was sleeping with her dealer. He confronted her about her behavior. She listened. There was no anger. Things seem better now. Huh? No anger? No anger, excuse me? No tears, shouting, or slammed doors? Come on, if only raising teenagers was that simple. Parenting is both a job and a joy. It does not require spyware, but it does require love, respect, time, trust. She goes on and on and on. Now, this is a woman who misses the obvious here. She's an advice columnist for Girls Life magazine, and she appears to be more troubled by parents who would use surveillance of their children's internet activity than about a teenage girl who's using drugs and sleeping with her dealer. I think most of us would think of that as bizarre, but evidently it makes sense to some readers of the New York Times. Another very interesting letter that came in, Jan Brotman writes, "The idea that a parent should threaten a child with putting spyware on his or her computer is irresponsible, alarmist, and misguided." Now, there's a triple threat, irresponsible, alarmist, and misguided. One of the reasons, I love this line, just figure out this logic. Now, one of the hardest things for us to do is figure out why the world makes sense to some people the way it does. All right, this is going to stretch you. One of the reasons children make poor choices in tough situations is that they lack their parents' trust. All right, let's rewind that for a moment. Let's see if that sentence makes sense to you. One of the reasons children make poor choices in tough situations is that they lack their parents' trust. All right, she goes on to say, if your child is on hard drugs and sleeping with a dealer, as was the daughter of Harlan Coben's friend, you're probably not paying enough attention to your kid. Well, that's true. I mean, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to use internet spyware to see where she's been on the internet if you don't know where she is physically. So I'll buy that part of the argument, but the idea that children make poor choices because they are not trusted by their parents, then again, that makes no sense to me whatsoever. You know, another one coming in here, this is Marissa, and it's interesting to me that all these are women writing in to say a much simpler solution to monitoring a child's behavior online is to keep computers out of bedrooms and put them into common areas of the house. Bingo. Yeah, absolutely. Another obvious thing, but it's not either or, we should add. Lazona says, a child can't help but consider the effect of a parent possibly looking over his or her shoulder. Yeah, you know, here's what I suggest, and if you listen to this program, you know I've been suggesting this for a long time. Use filtering software. Use the kind of tracking software that is talked about right here. Put the computer in the kitchen or in the family room, and do not allow the child unrestricted, unobserved, and unmonitored internet access. And at least insofar as the child is in your home, you're going to be in a much safer situation. Now, let me just ask you a question. What does it say about parenthood? What does it say when evidently a significant number of people think that it is indeed wrong, morally wrong for parents to put this kind of tracking information, tracking software on computers? What does that say about the notion that parents are something of an obstacle in a child's life, that parents are something of dictators taking on this kind of police enforcement when it comes to the lives of their children? Well, let me ask you an honest question. What if this were any other area of the child's life? I think almost anyone would say that parents should be monitoring where their children go, should be monitoring what their children read, should be keeping drugs away from their children, narcotics, should be keeping their children away from people who would peddle this kind of stuff. Well, how in the world can you consistently hold to that kind of logic? And I think even most secular parents would say that and then say, but don't worry about the internet, when the internet is the digital portal to all of that and more. I'd love to know what you think about this. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. You're on one side of this issue or the other. Do you think that Harlan Coben is right in suggesting that parents should not only have a right but a responsibility to monitor what their children and teenagers are doing on the internet? Or do you think that it's simply wrong? I'd love to hear the other side. Opposition calls are fully welcome. The phone number is 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. What do you think about this? What does this say about the way many people look at children? They think of children as autonomous individuals who are possessing all the rights to do as they want and to have some kind of zone of privacy in which any intervention is considered wrong on the part of parents. This is bizarre, but it also explains why the people who are running the schools have such trouble with children showing up with attorneys. You know, these days, if a child gets in trouble, it's generally the teacher who is more likely to be disciplined than the child. This is an inversion of the entire universe of values, but it's one of those issues that arises when you lose a clear sense of moral compass, as this culture is increasingly losing it, not by default, but by rejection. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Coast to coast and with listeners around the world, you're listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. The issue of pornography, violence, just awful material on the Internet is one that has caught the attention of many parents, but even many Christian parents underestimate what's really out there. It's not just pornography, as if you can say just pornography. It's the prevalence of some of the most perverse stuff, the prevalence of material that is just absolutely unthinkable. And, you know, quite frankly, it's indescribable even on a program like this. I can just tell you that the toxicity of it in the human soul is incalculable. And when you think about this being just a few clicks away from an adolescent or from a child, you realize we're talking about a whole new reality in human experience. Children in centuries past had no access to anything like this. Children, even in the magazine age, had to have some clever way of getting a hold of forbidden material in order to get a hold of it. And if their parents found it, they knew exactly what it was. But in the Internet age, every single child with access to the Internet has virtually unrestricted access to the worst stuff imaginable. And it's also just exactly what Harlan Coben was saying. It's violence, like watching, you know, video beheadings, as well as sex and other things as well. Harlan Coben, the novelist, was writing suggesting he now gets it. It's important for parents to monitor, restrict, and to surveil, that is, to track what is going on with their children and teenagers on the Internet. This has led to some controversy in the New York Times. I'll be fascinated to know what you think about it. The phone number to join the conversation is always available to you, and we want your calls. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Kevin's calling from Corydon, Indiana. Go ahead, Kevin.
Hi, Dr. Mohler. I agree 100% with what you're saying about parents needing to monitor what their kids are doing on the Internet. We don't use spyware, per se, but what we do is our computer is in a public place, and we hold the passwords to their accounts. We log them in when it's time for them to use the computer, and like the MySpace accounts, they're required to disclose their passwords to us so that...
Good for you. Are you there, Kevin?
But we're not spying on them in the sense of this article, but we are tracking what they're doing.
Yeah, I think that's very important. And I appreciate you bringing up MySpace, and I'll bring up Facebook. And we do the very same thing. We have teenage children, and we allow them to have some access to these sites, but we have the passwords, and we see everything. And by the way, what we see there is often appalling in terms of what Christian kids will put up on these sites, those who are linked to our children. But, I just wonder how many parents are actually looking at any of this stuff. So hats off to you, Kevin, for actually being involved in this. And I agree with you. I think most Christian parents will agree with you. Let's go to Denise calling from Kearney, Nebraska. Go ahead, Denise.
I totally agree. You need spyware. You don't have to spend much time on the Internet to realize you can be searching for something very innocent and get some really horrible stuff pop up in front of you. I don't think it's an issue about trusting your kids. It's an issue about trusting everyone else outside of your home, and you can't do that. You can't do that in any area of their lives. You can't trust everyone else.
What a great line. Yeah, that's a great argument, Denise. It's not really about trusting your children. It's about trusting pedophiles. Because, as you say, it's the people out there with all this stuff. You can't trust the people who would want to reach your children. And by the way, I do think, and I agree with you, that is the bigger issue. But, you know, I don't trust my children to have an absolute invulnerability to this kind of material, which they might even come across involuntarily. It's not just an issue of trust. Trust is the wrong word here. I actually do trust my children. I have a great deal of evidence and reason why I should trust them. But, you know, I also trust that my son could probably, 15 years old, walk safely across an 8-lane interstate. I think he could probably make it, but I would never let him do it, and I would never want to see it. And the idea that I would just open it up and say, hey, I think you're probably agile enough, you can make it across the traffic, that's just insane. I think I'd probably be charged with child abuse and taken into some court for making a child vulnerable in that way. So the trust is just the wrong word. It doesn't really even apply here. To join the conversation, give us a call. You can always email us at mail@albertmuller.com or go to albertmuller.com and drop us an email. We've got a lot of folks calling in. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We're talking about parents, children, teenagers, and the Internet. The issues are so complex, but the reality is fundamentally simple. You either parent here or you do not. The website at World Magazine that posted a link about this article, they had an interesting discussion there. One parent said that she was burned by reality. In other words, thinking her child was probably in good shape, finding out otherwise. The last line's fascinating. She says parents need to be a whole lot less trusting and a whole lot more parental. Interesting line there. Back with your calls. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. This whole idea of a zone of privacy for kids and teenagers is to me just, well, it wasn't a part of my experience. I'll just tell you that long before anyone had ever dreamed of an internet, I had a bedroom. And my father came in one afternoon and just started looking around my room. And I rather innocently said, are you looking for something in my room? He said, oh, this is my room. You get to live here. But never forget, this is my room. And I'll check whatever I want to check. And he did, and which was he was being a dad. I mean, that's what dads do. And he didn't do it when I wasn't there. He did it when I was there, which is to make the point. And boy, did it make a point. And then you start thinking about now, you have advocates as they pose themselves for children, who say the parents shouldn't even track or restrict what's going on the Internet. That sounds to me almost like the logic of the librarians who say there's a constitutional right for people to look at pornography even when children are in the public libraries. This is just insane stuff, but this is what we face in this confused culture. To join the conversation, it's still time for you to call 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Joni's calling from Louisville, Kentucky. Go ahead, Joni.
Hi, Dr. Mueller. I absolutely agree with using spyware on your computer. In my house, I can't be there all day, every day to see what my kids are doing. And I don't even have the internet anymore because it's not that I trust my kids. I do trust my kids, but I also trust that they're curious. And a site can very easily pop up that they're not trying to do. And they can find things that I don't want them to see, and they can meet people that I don't want them to meet. So it is the parents' responsibility, I feel, to what your kids are doing. And if you have to have spyware on your computer to do that, then by all means.
You know, Joni, I really appreciate your call, and it's great to get a perspective of a mom, because what you just added there is really important. And it shows your knowledge of your own children and love for them. As you say, you know, children are intensely curious. It's not that some child necessarily sits down to say, I want to go find X, Y, or Z, but when all of a sudden something comes up and says, you want to see this, there are an awful lot of kids who would say, yeah, I'd like to see what that looks like. And I'd like to know more about this, and et cetera, et cetera. You know, that's just why parents have to be there. I think that's a very good insight. And when you talk about trusting your children, we should trust them to be curious. That's a very good point. We should trust them to be inquisitive, trust them to be curious, and we should trust children to be immature. That's why they are children, okay? They are not little adults. You don't just add water and they all of a sudden turn into adults. They are developmentally moving through different periods and at different levels of maturity. Great point, Joni. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Bill calling from Mutley, New Jersey. Go ahead, Bill. All right. We lost Bill, but let's go with Lisa calling from Oneida, Tennessee. Go ahead, Lisa.
Hi, Dr. Mueller. I just want to say also, as the other callers, I agree with everything you said and with the author of that article. We don't have spyware, but I completely checked my teenage daughter's email. She's 15, and she doesn't even get on the computer without me checking it. She is not allowed to use chat rooms. She has to check with me about any websites, and she actually appreciates that I do that. She knows that I'm protecting her, and I know not so much now because I would delete some of the nonsense that came, but a lot of her Christian friends were sending emails that were very inappropriate, telling me that where were those Christian parents, you know, not knowing what their children were doing, and I would just delete them, and my daughter never got to see some of that nonsense.
You know, Lisa, that is such a good point. My wife has done the same thing for a long time for our kids. And, you know, I hear her tell me the same thing, how shocked she is about some of the emails and messages sent from kids from Christian homes that are bordering on the obscene, certainly vulgar and profane, written from Christian kids to other Christian kids, or forwarded messages, you know, the kind of message board thing that goes on with forwarded messages. You need to see this. Here's a joke. Here's a story. And it's just sick stuff. And it does make you aware in a whole new way that there are an awful lot of parents out there who are absolutely not touching this. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. You know, you think about hands-off parenting. Again, I go back to the same metaphor. You know, would you let your child just wander the streets at night? Of course not. Would you let your child go alone into any neighborhood at night? Of course not. Would you let your child go into, what my grandfather used to call a den of iniquity? Obviously not. But you're giving your children digital permission and digital access if you do not restrict and monitor online activity. Now, again, I want to go back to what I consider to be a very easily understood approach to this for the family. I'm not suggesting that you take the Internet out of the home. I think for most of us that's not actually very practical. But it's really not any different question than taking, in terms of approach, of taking the telephone out of the home. The issue is, what do you do with it? What kind of freedom, what kind of access do you allow? And when it comes to the Internet, I promise you this. If you've got children, younger children or teenage children, if the computer that has Internet access is in a public space where mom and dad are, and, you know, the illustration I often give, and when I talk to parents about teenagers, I often just use this example, and I talk to especially those of teenage boys, I'll say this, look, if the computer is in the kitchen and the kid is using the computer where mom is cutting the carrots, nothing too bad is going to happen. Because mom sees the screen and she has a knife in her hands. And I guarantee you that it is going to be very, very clear that there is a mom who is surveilling here and is watching what's going on. I would still add the filtering software, simply because even with kids who know they're being watched, accidents can happen. There are people who will send material to your children and put material in front of your children that they do not ask for. That needs to be filtered out insofar as it is possible to filter it. And then you do need the tracking software. I think that's important. And I know there are a lot of kids out there who are probably saying, that means my parents don't trust me. Well, let me just point out that that's why you have parents, because they're going to trust you to be, number one, a sinner. As parents must trust themselves to be sinners. And all sinners need all of the protection we can get against sin. And that's a reality, not just for children and teenagers, but for adults as well. And so when we're looking at the Internet problem, it's not just about the kids. Let's go to Barb calling from Palmer, Nebraska. Go ahead, Barb.
Hi. We have one family email account, so it's really easy to monitor what's coming in and what's going out, and friends know that mom and dad read the emails, so that's how we've chosen to do it.
You know, Barb, that is another good point, and I've heard quite a bit about that, actually, recently from parents who say, we've given up individual email accounts, we have a family email account, and so mom and dad, we just send the emails to the kids at the kitchen table if they need to deal with them, and there's no individual email account. That's not the answer for every family, but surveillance and protection and parental observation and regulation is. Back of final thoughts in just a moment. This has been a good conversation. I appreciate so many parents who've called in, and I think we need to note carefully that the callers have been parents. We'll be right back with the Albert Miller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Miller Program. That was a very interesting discussion. I especially appreciated the parents who called in, because this is an issue that all parents ought to think about, but not only think about, but act upon. Because right now, let me just get to the bottom line once again. If you are allowing your children at any age unfiltered access, unrestricted access, unmonitored access to the Internet, I want to suggest to you that you might as well be taking them into the seedier neighborhoods of an inner city and just letting them out and leaving them that vulnerable. Only it's worse, because even in physical space, they can only be in one space at one time. In the Internet, they can be in multiple places of perversion and violence and all the rest simultaneously and without parents even knowing. And while parents are thinking their children are safe, and not only that, they can be developing relationships through instant messaging and all the rest of this with people who may turn out indeed to be very dangerous to them. It's just another reminder that parenting in the 21st century is just a little more complicated than it was in times past, but the responsibility is the same. And that is to protect and to discipline and to teach children, to nurture them according to the Scripture and the nurture and admonition of the Lord. That obviously has a requirement for us about the Internet. We'll return to this issue from time to time. We were there today simply because of this interesting controversy, of all places, in the New York Times over this issue. When I close, let me just point out to you, you sometimes find clues about the culture in the most unexpected places. This Week magazine has a fascinating article on a crisis in the fortune cookie business. It turns out that there are a lot of fortune cookies eaten in America. The largest bakery, one bakery, turns out more than 4 million fortune cookies a day. That's more than a billion cookies a year. All of them has fortunes inside them. And the crisis is this. It's becoming harder and harder for people who write these little messages to come up with anything. And I've never considered them meaningful in the first place. But it turns out people read these things and take them very seriously in very confused America. And it turns out that the challenge in writing these for Americans is that every one of them, according to those who market them, have to be happy. In other words, when it comes to fortune, everybody's fortune has to be good and everything has to be uncomplicated. For instance, you have to be very careful. When one company came up with a fortune that said you will soon inherit a large sum of money, people complained that it meant that one of their loved ones are going to die. When it said you'll be going on a long voyage, a woman was offended because her husband died shortly after getting that message, evidently a longer voyage than indeed those who received the fortune cookie had expected. Now, it's very, very interesting because the original fortune cookies tended to have sayings from Confucius, the ancient Chinese sage, that it turns out that Americans just weren't tickled enough by those sayings of wisdom from Confucius, and instead everything has to have a happy ending. That really tells you a great deal, by the way, about America, that Americans want a fortune in their cookie. But it better be positive, it better not make them think, and it better not even be possible of offending anyone. That means it can't mean anything. Just remember that next time you get your fortune cookie. Back next week for Intelligent Christian Conversation. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.